This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin and with me, Julian Ng. This morning, we have an exciting lineup for you. This includes a breakfast grill with Dato Ahmad Abu Bakar, Group Managing Director of UDA Holdings. We're going to actually be talking to him as Ibrahim Sani. Julian, how was your evening? Did you get enough rest?
How was my evening? Yes, it was quite good, but not quite enough rest. I wish I could stay in bed. Just maybe 7 minutes longer.
You know, there's an interesting problem with people of our age, Julian. I say that. Between 40 and 60.
Are we in the same age group?
Okay. We are. I know you're in denial,
right.
But actually, people between 40 and 60 don't get enough sleep. And this is, perhaps it varies across the globe, but it's such epic proportions in Britain. The message that the health authorities there are putting out to people in that age group is that your bodies are rotting. Mm-hmm. And it's rotting because you're not getting enough sleep. And
it's so surprising, isn't it? This kind of findings that you can die from lack of sleep.
Yeah, dying might be a blessing.
A very extreme way of saying it.
No, dying would be a blessing because with a rotting body, you're just carrying your carcass around, limping around like a zombie. And, you know, and I think people don't appreciate how important it is to get at least 6 hours of sleep. I think most people just need that to, you know, for everything to restore itself and to reset for the next day. There are exceptions to the rule, and people often quote them, you know, the Margaret Thatchers and such, you know, who need 2 hours or whatever.
Famously. Yeah, she'd take these 2 minute or 5 minute power naps.
Yeah, and you know, so that's one. Power naps are good to restore you, but a good night's sleep, long, extended, with, you know, healthy dreams,
healthy dreams.
Healthy dose of dreaming, and I don't mean whatever the content of that dream might be, just, you know, deep sleep that gives you dreams. So I think all that, very necessary. But
I think that the breakfast grill will keep you awake because UDA Holdings is a very interesting company because they are kind of tied to the Bumiputra policy as well, where they develop a lot of stuff, especially in Kampung Baru. And they've got pieces of land here and there in downtown KL, prime land, very, very prime land. You're talking about Kampung Baru, Bukit Bintang City Centre, things like that. So we asked them about not only development, but the state of the nation's Bumiputra policy.
I think it's fascinating because there are debates ongoing over, you know, the involvement of the state. Because the state, seen as a protector of Bumiputra interests, extending it in terms of equity holdings and such. And I think Wan Saifu Wanjan very recently wrote a piece in The Star, saying that basically while the government has been saying that they're pulling back as a major player in the economy, the facts don't bear it out. And so he says, as somebody coming from an organization pushing a liberal agenda, one that would like to see the state shrunk significantly and move out of certain sectors in life in Malaysia, including the economy, I think it's a debate worth visiting again. We need to have this debate based on, as it were, facts on the ground. The data is there. And so I urge you, I think Wan Saifu Wanjan's column comes out in The Star. I could see if I can find a link to that, Julian, and we can tweet that out.
Okay.
I think it would be a very exciting,
and that will tie
discussion.
In very nicely to the grill today as well.
Well, you're on your S&M show, one full of whips and yelping individuals.
Yes.
What's on for S&M this morning?
I don't know about the yelping, but it's also a question that we are addressing, whether the market will whip you into some kind of a submission, because the market has been going up for possibly half a decade now since the global financial crisis way back in 2008. At that point in time, the market crashed very sharply, and the subsequent rebound was very strong as well, driven by all the money printing that's happening all around the world and has fueled the rise of the market over the last few years. And today we're going to ask the question when it's going to end, and not only when it's going to end, but whether the market will go into a prolonged bear session, which is a bear market is a market that is coming down. That's not to be confused with a bull market, which is when the market goes up in a sustained fashion.
Right, charges forth. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, you know, whips can cower you, reduce you to submission, but they can also excite you. So I think the S&M show explores both sides of the whip.
There is this very funny story. I can't verify it, and I can't say that what I'm saying is the absolute authority on this. But there was this part of New York where they erected a wall, right, on this street called Wall Street. That had to separate the bears from attacking this farm, which had a lot of bulls. And so,
yeah, and therefore, and that's the apocryphal big origins of Wall Street. Very interesting. Wall Street has a fascinating history, including being the target for one of the first car bombs.
What year was that?
I think it was the early part of the 20th century, and it wasn't quite a car. It was a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, and the person involved was called Buddha. And there's a brilliant book by Mike Davis called Buddha's Wagon, which traces the history of the car bomb, and it begins with the Wall Street bombing.
You've mentioned this before, and I still have yet to get that book, which the title is really fascinating to
Buddha.
Me.
I think they were Hungarian. They were Hungarian brothers. They were anarchists.
It's in Budapest, is it?
Absolutely. But I don't know if the name comes from there. But anyway, that was their name. I think they're Hungarian of origin. But anarchists, more importantly. Moving on to some of the news, Julian, because yesterday's news that Singapore was closing the Swiss bank, BSI SA's unit in the city-state, was quite a stunning development in the story of 1MDB because this is all linked to, in some ways, goes back to the 1MDB issue.
Yeah.
And Switzerland began criminal proceedings against the firm because basically saying that if they had their processes in place and they'd done their due diligence, they wouldn't have been wouldn't have facilitated what are allegations around criminal activity 1MDB. So I think the 1MDB story, instead of kind of achieving closure, seems to be opening up again and in a very ripe fashion across the world.
Anti-money laundering laws are in existence everywhere in the world. It's really just a question of whether you want to enforce them. And Singapore is sending a very clear message to all the banks in that city-state. Of course, Singapore has in the past been accused of a haven for dirty money, for example, from Indonesia, from Russia, from China, and they take great offense at those kind of accusations, to the extent of hunting down the analysts who say such thing and asking the firms to fire that particular analyst
who wrote
those kind of articles and research. I think they're sending a very clear message, and this is where the investigations diverge between Singapore and Malaysia, right? Because in Malaysia, you had that $7 million saga by Nazir Razak in his bank account. And one wonders whether issues have reached the desk of Bank Negara, whether they're investigating whether there was any wrongdoing in this kind of thing. But in Singapore, well, they've removed the license of a bank.
Yeah, so the Monetary Authority of Singapore said it will withdraw BSI Bank's limited's license for breaches of money laundering rules, and it will impose a 13.3 million Sing dollar fines or financial penalties on the BSI unit for 41 breaches. Also, Singapore authorities have referred six senior BSI executives to the public prosecutor, including the private bank's former chief executive officer. So it looks like not only are they taking away the license, the people are going to be held to account for their actions. And I think that is going to be a major story in the weeks to come.
The reverberations are going to be fantastic. Not fantastic in a positive sense, but it's just going to be so all permeating into the financial world as to their activities. When you want to do something, you got to really think twice about what you're doing, whether that's right or wrong in the eyes of the law, at least in the Singapore law.
Well, you know, some people believe that eventually your sins catch up with you. Some people believe that justice is such that some people get away with everything, including murder. But Mr. Funny Man Bill Cosby is apparently going to be standing trial for charges of sexual assault. He's been dodging, allegations of sexual assault for years now, and he's managed to keep it under wraps. But apparently no longer. Mr. Cosby, who's 78, has been accused of drugging and molesting a former Temple University employee in his home in Philadelphia in 2004. So that's... he was well into his 60s by that time. So that's, 12 years ago. So he was 66.
This has been going on for a long time. I mean, we're talking decades here, and we're talking about a pattern in behavior. And so I think this would have, I am sure many people are really sad to learn that one of their favorite childhood characters in the Cosby Show, that image has been shattered.
Absolutely. I think it's been for some time now, and, American comedians, everybody's kind of weighed in on that. On both sides of the divide, people supporting him and those who feel that he needs to come clean on these allegations. Apparently, the case was reopened after, last year when some 40 women came forward with similar accusations. So you're right, it's a question. It's not a one-off, it is a pattern of behavior that he's being accused of. Now, the other big story is the war on ISIS, Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. The analysts are saying that, in fact, the ISIS is being pushed back. It's in a retreat. But one of the latest bits of information that's come out is new satellite imagery showing extensive damage to a strategic airbase in central Syria used by Russian forces. Russian forces, of course, Gillian, have been very successful in targeting ISIL or ISIS targets there. Apparently, 4 helicopters and 20 lorries were destroyed. So the war continues, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the war on democracy in Maldives also continues. But perhaps a little bit of light on the horizon for at least one person, the former Maldivian president, who was the country's first democratically elected leader. He was sentenced to 13 years in prison on charges of terrorism. He, of course, denied it. He was a lawyer and a human rights lawyer. He was, despite his imprisonment, he was allowed to go to Britain for spinal surgery. And at which point he took exile. Yeah. So a really sad case of a country transiting to democracy and then falling back very sharply.
The force of the dark side is strong.
Yeah, well, Star Wars. Yes. Well, I think it's also the question of institutions, right? With all democracies and transitions and the big debates about what's happening in Myanmar today. I mean, people almost expect in a magical fashion for Aung San Suu Kyi to be delivering on all promises, on all issues of human rights. But she has had to renegotiate a very tricky minefield, and a tricky minefield that's going to be there for some time. If other examples of transitions to democracy are anything to go by, it's not that easy to transit to democracy.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the minefields that she is negotiating?
Well, the military has control over lots of institutions of governance. They're still very big. They have representation without necessarily being elected. They control much of the economy. So, and then there's all these nefarious groups that have been, formed by the military in order to stir up trouble, to create, to undermine the democratic process. They seem to be backing the right-wing Buddhist chauvinist agenda in Myanmar. Again, as we saw in many countries that were transiting democracy, the old powers try to make it very difficult for the new powers
to stick around for longer than they're welcome. And Shirai, we were in Bangkok over the weekend, And, you know, this cast of pallor that a lot of analysts have cast over the country, saying that it's just sliding away from democracy after 1 or 2 years of rule by the military. And
well, 2 years, in fact, Sunday,
2 years, right?
the second anniversary. It was the second anniversary
and,
of the coup.
You know, the impression that I got over there, I checked this up, right, that the Thai people are generally very happy people. I mean, they rank quite highly on global happiness indices, in spite of what's going on.
But did you see the streets? I thought Bangkok were extraordinarily empty. I spoke to traders.
Well, because of the Vesak holiday, I suppose.
Well, I think there was Vesak, but there was also, I think generally, tourism numbers are down. I spoke to taxi drivers and traders. And, you know, I spent some time on a fellowship in Bangkok. I spent 6 months there. I've never seen Bangkok so empty. And, you know, I was quite shocked by what I experienced. Anyway, the last bit of news that we probably want to deliver this morning before we take a break is the fact that Twitter plans to exclude photos and video from its 140 character limit. I don't know if this is a great idea, but that's what they've decided.
Well, I mean, technically speaking, photos and videos are not characters, right? How do you estimate space, right?
It takes up ones and zeros.
I don't know. I have not read the full news of this, but I think that, as you would agree, Sharad, the 140 character limit is a way of just directing focus. You know, if you keep to that 140 character rule, then you are forced to elucidate your thoughts.
In a very succinct manner. Absolutely. Yeah. I can imagine those officials at BSI, SA, in Singapore having a nervous breakdown as a result of the news now coming out. And perhaps around the world, many bankers that have gotten their fingers a little sullied by activities less than legal also might be having the bit of the jitters.
Yeah, I think the other guy who, the other casualty was from Goldman Sachs, Tim Leisner, but he had resigned. So I guess he escaped before any real, proceedings were taken against him. So that perhaps he's saved and he's enjoying his pina colada in some exotic Caribbean island.
Well,
somewhere.
I don't know about that. I believe I read something about him being called up for questioning. And also, if you look at the Singapore case, the former CEO is also being called up. I mean, so you might resign, but doesn't mean you're going to escape, criminal proceedings if you, in fact, have committed a crime. And so, you know, the hand of the law, they say, can be very long.
And we Malaysians, here's a lesson for us, right? We have always been dissing Singapore about how such a fine country they are, fining you for every single thing, for chewing gums, for littering, keeping their country really clean and antiseptic. Here's one thing that I support going on this witch hunt and trying to protect the integrity of the system. I think it's a good thing they're doing. I support you, Singapore.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a witch hunt because I think witch hunts are about things that are not quite there, that you imagine are there and you're kind of like going after innocence. But in this case, they might actually be guilty as charged.
You know, a lot of bankers would think that what they had done was not wrong. So they're probably in denial.
Bankers are such strange creatures. I don't think I've ever met one. Oh, sorry. You were one, weren't you, before, Julian?
I was in the dark side before, yes, I was.
Okay, but you come over into the light.
Into radio, no less.
Okay. The other story, I think, and before we get into the question of Lego, and I just tweeted out some links to, the issue of Lego, is a kind of heartwarming story of a U.S.-born Malaysian dubbed the American Messi. He's inked a deal with the St. Louis FC, football club. It's an American football club. The young man in question is one cuisine, one Kamal. And apparently he's become an overnight sensation on video that showed him, you know, playing football recently. It's a nice story because, you know, we often are not making happy stories globally, and so this one.
We get so excited when Malaysians are mentioned somewhere, especially in the land of the huge, like the land of America. I think this is a big deal for us, isn't it?
Well, I think there is something about the Malaysian diaspora. You know, it suggests that, we have talent, that, you know, we're not bereft of talent. Maybe talent has left our shores. And this young man is not even Malaysian born, but I think for some time we're going to be claiming him. I don't know what, yes. What's left of him. You know, we have Penny Wong in Australia, so Sabahan, who's made it really big.
She's the mayor of...
she was finance minister under
finance
Labour government.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
And, you know, and the question, of course, with her, because she's a lesbian and she's had a child with her partner, yeah. Whether somebody like that could find a place under the Malaysian sun, I think is always a big question.
Yeah, I think it's great. On the one hand, it's great that you see Malaysians achieving all these greatness. But on the other hand, I'm just wondering if we are living vicariously, because nothing much happens at home, and we get excited about Malaysians doing it, making it good in foreign lands.
Yeah, well, you know, I do believe that the good things happen here. We don't see enough. It's probably clouded by all the bad news.
The other thing is, I just want to have a quick mention that there is a lot of money in sports, as we all. It's the most obvious statement ever made by me. China.
No, I don't think it's the most. But
China.
It's up there. It's high up there, Julian.
Chinese fund has bought a controlling stake, a 65% stake in a leading sports media rights company called MP and Silver, and it values MP and Silver at $1.5 billion.
Wow.
So these are guys who, I guess, manage all those sponsorships and advertisements for sports-related organizations and personalities.
So this young US-born Malaysian, probably on the right track to some sort of success. Now, the other thing that's valued high, and you might be surprised, is Lego. Apparently, Lego that's well kept and that's not damaged keeps its value. Its value, in fact, is stronger than gold over time.
It's really interesting, I guess. It's got to do with nostalgia. It's got to do with the scarcity of those old products. And the fact that you might get a lot more satisfaction out of playing with Lego than you would with gold.
But to be in mint condition, you probably don't want to play with it.
Which is look at the pictures, some of which are getting more and more violent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about, not taking toys out of the wrapping in order to keep them in mint condition. I think the whole point about toys is to use them. But I know that people who collect comics, for instance, keep them very carefully. They keep them in the thing. And they're not well thumbed. I mean, I think the idea is to have mint condition comics because then they retain their value. It's a very strange way of dealing with a much-loved commodity, which is, in some ways... deny yourself the pleasure of the object, right? I mean,
I think it's about collectors looking into the future and deciding which items would have more value than others. It's like a little time capsule that they're playing around with. And markets are driven by scarcity, right? You talk about things like gold, bitcoins, Lego sets, comics, even art pieces, masterpieces. You can never create these things ever again because those guys are dead. That's the primary reason. But the other reason is that these art pieces are so rare and so scarce that they keep rising in value and they actually make good investments.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that there's a lot of controversy over art as investment. It's not just that the artist is dead, but they should have had a body of work. So I think there's several things that go into the mix in creating value around art. But yeah, it is also a fascinating topic. The one thing I do want to say, if you had to, put up as a candidate for value in toy, what it would be, I would talk about Hornby Railways. I mean, those trains. I never got a set as a child because they were just far too expensive for my parents to buy. But as an adult, I think I'm going to go out one day and buy myself that Hornby Railways set.
Well, I think those should be stuff for museums, for everybody to appreciate. And I would say if you're the apocalypse type, just buy into canned foods. So that if or when the world ends, you can at least trade
Julian, you know.
Open one up for yourself to consume or trade it with some other.
It's Wednesday. It's hump day. No talk about the apocalypse, please.
We started by talking about death, didn't we? Okay.
No, we... No, I'll stop. Maybe. Okay. We haven't got a a tweet in for anything we've been saying so far. But that doesn't mean you're not listening. I'm very certain that, you know, we're all deeply engaged in questions. And just to finish up on that Twitter conversation we were having, a conversation about Twitter, Julian, earlier, that they're going to exclude media and photographs and such, you know, from the 140 character count. I think it's, you know, moving away from the concept, a really strong concept, into something like, you know, the Facebooking of Twitter, or, you know, and the Facebookerization, rather. If I can get my English.
I understand,
right.
You.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think when you water down the concept, you really kill your product.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can be in a position where my Twitter feed is just full of 140 characters or less garbage, right? I guess it's also a question of who I follow on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, sometimes the message can get lost in that news feed, which is just constantly moving. And Twitter is all about having that feel of the zeitgeist, about what's going on at a glance. And sometimes I lose that. And I get more of that from Facebook. I mean, they say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? So it's a certain breach of that 140 character limit.
Okay, so I mean, Twitter, yeah. And so I think recognizing the limits of Twitter, because the Twitter feed just continues. Though if you're interested in a topic and there's a hashtag associated with it, or a term, you can actually search that. So you can recover, as it were, the thread along a topic, for instance. I believe one of the things that's trending now, I was quite surprised, is give Captain America a boyfriend. It's got 216,000 tweets.
Wow.
I don't know, something, hashtag 1MDB is trending. So if you missed out and you want to capture everything that's been tweeted out, you know, on the question of 1MDB and that has that hashtag, you could. So I think that...
Certainly two of the busiest entities around trying to defend whatever they're doing.
1MDB and Captain America.
That's right.
Yeah,
yes.
I guess.
Very heavy responsibilities.
And I guess Captain America needs some love as well. But there you have it, you know, Captain America. Okay, Twitter, I'm just coming, just very quickly on Twitter. I think the proof of the pudding will be in the eating or the tasting, as it were.
Whatever. Our English is getting worse.
Or is it? Okay, so we just tweeted out a link to a story about how being a native English speaker globally is useless if you can't speak other varieties of English. And, you know, it's now become commonly accepted that English comes in varieties. And we know that, of course, even English in England, or not beyond the boundaries of England, to Wales, to Scotland, to Ireland, changes, right?
Yeah.
So if you meet really existing British people, you know they speak a variety of English themselves.
I think the standard English has moved from the Queen's English to an American English, because Hollywood is one of America's big exporters, and we adopt many of their ways of speaking, but still it involves a lot of nuance. It's very nuanced, and it's littered with slang words. So is the British English, also very littered with slang words. And many times these native speakers, when they go out into the world and work with peoples from all walks of life, they find themselves being very hard to understand. A guy from America saying, give me a ballpark figure, for instance, to a Japanese. The Japanese guy doesn't understand what ballpark means.
The idiomatic expressions that develop in the various kind of national context or regional context of a language, right? But the idea is, and I always thought this was true, that if you have a very strong foundation in standard English, that will allow you to actually enter and participate in other varieties of English, just because you kind of know the foundations of the language. But there's some dispute about that. And, you know, it seems that you still have to immerse yourself in those other contexts in order to be understood or you communicate effectively.
Yeah, and I've visited America a few times, and in areas, of course, in New York and San Francisco, where really you have a lot of foreigners there, a lot of migrant workers, and there are advertisements, signs around the city saying, asking you to take up courses which will make you speak like an American. So it's not the case where the Native American speakers are molding themselves to the rest of the world. But if you go to America, which to me seems like the standard bearer of how English is spoken right now, today, you got to learn how to speak like them. And you got to learn about ballpark figures and about other idioms in order to communicate effectively.
You know, I think we have schools in KL, at least, that, you know, that English language schools that call themselves, you know, London English and stuff like that. Well, it was very interesting. But when in Bangkok, on one of the main thoroughfares in Siloam, there was something called Wall Street English. And I was quite surprised by that. And I thought, oh, that's a very clever way. Maybe
that's
of advertising.
A dying language, isn't it?
Wall Street language? I don't know.
With the kind of troubles that they're going through. But anyway,
you know, but they're rich, you know, and they influence everybody and everything. But the idea, of course, is that, and this has been popularized across the world, the idea of business English, that somehow you can pare down the English language and kind of use it as a tool for communicating in that specific life world of business and business people, that somehow you will have a lesson on the ballpark figure or guesstimate or all these other words that are produced by business types and, you know, technocrats in the world of finance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a little experience of mine when I was in Hong Kong. You know, we Malaysians speak our brand of dialects, what we know as Hokkien or Cantonese and so on. I thought I was speaking Cantonese until I went to Hong Kong. And they, of course, have a totally different brand of Cantonese there. They have their own slang words and their own idioms that make Malaysian, at least a poor Cantonese speaker in Malaysia, completely at a loss in Hong Kong until I started watching a very old kung fu movie in Hong Kong. And that was when it hit me that, you know, that's what I understand, right? That movie that was made in the 50s or the 40s or 60s, that is the kind of Cantonese that I'm speaking. And our Cantonese, at least in my very limited circle of, you know, Chinese-speaking friends, I mean, we have our Cantonese having been distilled for a few decades and not moving along with the developments of Hong Kong accent or the Hong Kong slang and idioms.
Right. This other thing that I found fascinating in a discussion that was happening at the office yesterday about Hokkien in Penang. And, you know, with the assertion made by one person that Hokkien, in fact, is dying, that a lot of people don't understand Hokkien or the complexity of the language. A lot of words have dropped out of use and or people don't recognize them anymore. And that there is somebody, a Penangite based in the US, who's trying to revive Hokkien and, you know, kind of producing podcasts.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fun to listen to Hokkien being spoken anywhere.
And do you understand Hokkien? Are you a Hokkien speaker?
Just a little bit. I'm actually Hokkien. My ethnicity is actually Hokkien, but I don't, because by virtue of being in KL, I only speak Cantonese and some very basic Mandarin.
All right. I think, you know, coming back to the question of varieties of English, right? There are people who will say we should celebrate Manglish, which is the Malaysian variety.
I agree.
And those who say, well, that might be good for somebody who can switch between standard English and the Manglish version. But if you're caught in Manglish, then you can't travel with that English.
Yeah.
And so
I think you've got to be multilingual. No Manglish and English.
Absolutely.
So different languages.
Well, they're not entirely different languages, but they're significantly different. So it's what I think linguists or sociolinguists call code switching. You kind of recognize the context in which you are, and I found that when I was in India as well, that the kind of English I spoke didn't always translate well in the Indian context that I was in. And so I had to be much more sensitive to, you know, what was happening around me and then transform or change my language, accommodate to what they were seeing. Now, apparently we have Nick Hasuddin tweeted in saying that there's a panel this morning on political financing that includes somebody we spoke about earlier, you know, One Cipher, One Jan. He's on the panel. He's, of course, is from the Institute of Democracy and Economics. Economic Affairs. I've asked Nick Hasuddin to give us more details about where this is happening. On that panel is also Tan Sri Johan Jaffa. He's the moderator. He's the former Media Prima Berhad chairman. You might remember him. And this morning also, there are going to be remarks made by a minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Senator Paul Lau. He's there too. A story, and in fact, we had on, I think, the bigger picture some weeks ago, Terence Gomez, academic at University of Malaya, speaking about political financing. Very important issues for a country struggling to improve governance, I believe, in terms of politics. But we're going to be coming back, after the 7 o'clock news. But first, here's Supergrass, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.